Today is Friday, October the 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. The U.S. House of Representatives voted to hold Steve Bannon, one of former President Donald Trump's closest allies, in criminal contempt of Congress.
On this vote, the yeas are 229, the nays are 202. The resolution is adopted.
And the U.S. Supreme Court kicked off this month its first in-person oral arguments since the coronavirus pandemic forced the proceedings to go virtual 19 months ago. However, some scholars worry that the current court will likely rule along ideological lines on some of the most divisive issues in American politics.
But what happened is now the dominance is to get justices of the same political philosophy of the party in power.
And a COVID-19 lockdown in the Australian city of Melbourne, officially the world's most locked down city, ended on Thursday. We'll have these stories and more coming up right here on International Edition. Stay tuned. And for our top story, the House voted to hold Steve Bannon, a longtime ally and aide to former President Donald Trump, in contempt of Congress for refusing to testify before the committee investigating the January Capitol riot. The AP's Ed Donahue reports.
Committee member Wyoming Republican Liz Cheney pointed out what Bannon said on a podcast the day before the riot.
He said all hell is going to break loose.
Cheney says it's clear Bannon must have been aware and may have been involved in the planning of what played out that day.
The American people deserve to hear his testimony.
Republicans like Indiana's Jim Banks say this is a witch hunt.
He is a Democrat Party boogeyman. The Select Committee despises Steve Bannon's politics. So they're abusing their power to put him in jail.
The decision to prosecute rests with Attorney General Merrick Garland. He says the Justice Department
will apply the facts and the law and make a decision consistent with the principles of prosecution.
Ed Donahue, Washington.
The vote marks a significant escalation and is a sign of how far Democrats are willing to go after individuals who refuse to cooperate with the Select Committee. Meanwhile, former President Donald Trump says that he's returning to social media, but it won't be where you used to find him. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
Trump says he's launching a new media company with its own social media platform. The former president says his goal in launching the Trump Media and Technology Group and its Truth Social app is to create a rival to the big tech companies that have shut him out. He was barred from Twitter and Facebook 9 months ago for his role in inciting the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. Social media served as Trump's megaphone in his rise in national politics. And as president, Trump used Twitter daily, taking jabs at political rivals and those who crossed him, and sometimes to announce policy. I'm Ben Thomas.
This week, Republicans voted to prevent a major voting rights bill from advancing in the U.S. Senate. The bill was aimed at blocking restrictive new voting laws enacted in Republican-led states. This is the third time this year that Senate Democrats have tried to advance the voting rights bill. And analysts say that some of those voting rights issues could ultimately end up in the courts, working their way to the Supreme Court. However, they worry that as recent as July of this year, the Supreme Court voted along ideological lines to uphold a restrictive voting law in Arizona. The Supreme Court, which started a new term this month, will consider cases on some of the most divisive issues in American politics, including abortion. And former Senator Russ Feingold recently said that the court faces a legitimacy crisis and is in need of reform. Richard Jacobs is the author of the new book, Democracy of Dollars, Where Natural and Constitutional Rights Go to the Highest Bidder. In his book, Mr. Jacobs examines the systemic threats to democracy in 21st century America. In the second part of our three-part conversation, he says that one of the major threats to American democracy is that politicians have become, quote, willing resources to special interests, with the judicial branch becoming their unwitting handmaiden, end quote. He says that that's why in the last decade, judges have been primarily appointed on the basis of their political views.
Now, Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas recently says that the Supreme Court, as we understand it now, may have become the most dangerous branch of government. And he said that, you know, it still works, but that the media are making people think that the justices are politicians. Is he correct in blaming the media?
Well, the media may enter into it, but what really has happened is we've appointed judges which dominate a particular political party viewpoint. If you go back to what was originally planned and thought, judges would be appointed by presidents over time. So let's say you're the president for 4 years, you might get a chance to appoint one or two judges. I'm the president for the next 4 years, I get a chance to appoint one or two judges. Your political philosophy may be different than mine, but that blends differences and points of view. It's really a healthy thing. But what happened is now the dominance is to get justices of the same political philosophy of the party in power. You can't make decisions with justices with one point of view. We're a diverse country with many points of view, and you have to take in and blend and compromise between all the different points of view.
Mm. Now, analysts say that the real danger to American democracy are the legal and legislative reforms in mostly Republican states, you know, Republican-led states. So far, after claims of vote rigging by the former President Trump, we see that 19 states have enacted at least 31 new laws to restrict voting and voting rights and kind of overhaul elections. How much of what we see right now in real time is a real time erosion of democracy as we know it? And what role would the judiciary play in correcting that?
Okay, you've touched on a very, very important problem, that's voter suppression, which is very destructive of democracy, because as you pointed out, democracy is supposed to be the will of the people expressed through their votes, and the legislators and the executive branches then operate on the basis of those votes. The dangerous thing that the judiciary did a few years ago was to approve what is known as partisan gerrymandering, which I discuss in Democracy of Dollars at quite some length. When I was in law school back in the 1960s, it was considered to be illegal. In other words, you couldn't gerrymander in order to give the party in power power. You had to design your voting districts to be fair to everybody. But what happened is with the Roberts Court, they decided that gerrymandering on a partisanship basis was not prohibited by the Constitution. So that put the states into full swing to try to gerrymander the voting rights of people by changing the voting districts to keep the party in power. Now, the court would have to reverse its position on gerrymandering in order to overcome that. And that may be highly doubtful. Although the polls in the United States have said that gerrymandering, 90% of the people, Republicans and Democrats, have said that they don't believe in gerrymandering. And if you go back to what the presidents have said, although they've done nothing about it, even Ronald Reagan said that gerrymandering was an atrocity. So we have public opinion on one side, we have the court making a decision that, hey, we can't do anything about it, the states have the right to gerrymander. And that is one of the major functions to destroy democracy.
And how important was the Citizens United, the 2010 court decision that many say, you know, further tilted political influence towards the wealthy donors and corporations reversing century-old campaign finance restrictions? How important is that in retrospect to what to the erosion of democracy and democratic ideals here in America?
Well, that was a major contributor to the fact that the democracy today is a democracy of dollars. The winners are those that put up the money. So we get votes that way. So you and I, if we don't have $1 million to contribute to a political party or a political candidate, we don't have the voice of somebody that does. And that's a very unfortunate thing. That should be changed.
That was retired lawyer and constitutional scholar Richard Jacobs. He was speaking to me from his home in Florida. White House floats new plans to pay for parts of President Joe Biden's $2 trillion domestic spending package, AP's Mike Garcia reports.
With the clock ticking toward a self-imposed deadline, the White House is offering to shift off a key component of how to pay for President Joe Biden's $2 trillion social services and climate package. The White House is prepared to keep the corporate tax rate at 21%, shelving a hike to 26.5% favored by many Democrats for companies earning more than $5 million a year. Instead, there would be a new tax on gains of those with more than $1 billion in assets. In his hometown of Scranton, Pennsylvania, Wednesday, Biden was sounding confident.
This has been declared dead on arrival from the moment I introduced it. But I think we're going to surprise them.
But the clock is ticking. Democratic leaders in Congress want agreement by week's end. Mike Gracia, Washington.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is making a major push for democracy on his first journey to South America as U.S. Secretary of State, visiting two democracies, Ecuador and Colombia, at a time of rising violence, authoritarianism, and populism in the region. VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sen reports.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken praised the stable democracies of Colombia and Ecuador on Wednesday, even though he arrived in Ecuador just as new President Guillermo Lasso declared a state of emergency to combat drug-related violence. Blinken said the Biden administration realizes that in the past, the U.S. has focused too much on training and equipping security forces and promoting democratic elections in the region, and not enough on boosting people's economic well-being.
This should be obvious, but the reality is we've often put more energy into strengthening civil and political rights, as vital and important as they are, free and fair elections, the rule of law, freedom of speech and assembly, and less into strengthening people's economic and social rights, like bolstering labor standards, expanding access to adequate education and health, providing more inclusive opportunities.
Blinken also received a warm welcome in Bogota, Colombia, from President Iván Duque. Duque was criticized after Colombian forces had killed dozens of anti-government protesters this year. But as Benjamin Gadan of the Wilson Center told VOA, Colombia is a critical U.S. ally in the region.
Colombia is a longtime United States ally in a very difficult part of Latin America. Of course, its neighbor, Venezuela, is a failed state and a deeply repressive dictatorship. The result has been almost 6 million Venezuelans fleeing in recent years, and perhaps half of them have settled in neighboring Colombia.
The political impasse in Venezuela and the resulting humanitarian crisis were high on the agenda at both of Blinken's stops. That partly explains why Blinken focused on the urgency of promoting democracy in the region, as Gadan explains.
But in reality, Latin America is living through a real democratic crisis right now. Nicaragua, Venezuela, of course, Cuba are all authoritarian right now. And countries like El Salvador are moving in that direction. Even Brazil has shown some warning signs lately about the respect for independent judiciaries and other democratic institutions.
Governments not able to deliver economically contribute to the migration crisis we are witnessing and make Blinken's push for democracy even more timely, Keith Mines of the United States Institute of Peace told VOA.
There's the kind of low-functioning democracies in other parts of Central America that are not able to provide fully for their citizens and leads to migration crises and things like that. And then, of course, the failed democracy of Haiti, which is just one that has kind of left the realm of functionality altogether.
Mind said China is promoting a very different model. Secretary Blinken said the United States is not trying to force any country to choose between it and China, but it is seeking to promote the highest possible standards for human rights and living and working conditions for all citizens of the Americas. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
A group of mixed-race women who were abducted as children by state officials in what was then Belgian Congo is suing the Belgian state for crimes against humanity. As Henry Ridgewell reports, the case comes as Belgium struggles to reconcile with its brutal colonial past.
Leah Tavares Mujinga was born in the Belgian Congo, now the Democratic Republic of Congo, to a white Belgian father and a black Congolese mother. When she was 2 years old, while her father was away, Belgian colonial officials snatched her from her home. Speaking last year, Mujinga described what happened. She told AFP, they took me away from my mother, who was with me at that time, from my parents' home, to put me in a religious institution in Katende, the Catholic mission of Katende, with the Sisters of St. Vincent de Paul, as they did with other children before me. And my elder brother was also kidnapped a year before me. The state's actions were motivated by race. Mujinga said, if a white man or a white woman marries a black man or a black woman, it is seen as a sin. So the child is considered as a child of prostitution. So that's what we were called, children of sin. Mujinga said she suffered from malnutrition and still bears the physical and mental scars. Thousands of children were taken away from their African mothers by Belgian authorities. After Congo gained independence in 1960, lawyers say they were abandoned. Mujinga is one of five women, now all in their 70s, who suffered that fate as children and are now suing the Belgian government. They are seeking compensation of $55,000 each, a relatively small amount, because if they lose, the women will have to pay a percentage of that sum to the state. The case has much wider implications, says their lawyer, Michel Hirsch. Hirsch told VOA those of mixed race were seen as a threat to the colony, a threat to the colonial system, and also a threat to the supremacy of the white race. And what Belgium, the Belgian state, put in place during colonization was a system to eliminate children. Lawyers say the Belgian state wanted to prevent interracial unions and make sure the so-called Métis children would not claim a link with Belgium in later life. Belgium officially apologized in 2019 for its role in abducting mixed-race children in its African colonies. But Hirsch says it doesn't go far enough. She said the system that was put in place by the Belgian state can be qualified as a crime against humanity because it was a systematic attack against a civilian population, children of mixed race, that is to say for racial reasons. The Belgian state admitted the facts but never compensated in any way. And today, in court, the Belgian state still refuses to compensate. The civil court in Brussels is expected to deliver a verdict within 6 weeks. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The UN Development Programme is launching a plan to help millions of Afghans who have lost their livelihoods in the midst of a recent political turmoil regain the ability to earn a living and feed their families. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The speed and degree to which Afghanistan's economy has imploded since the Taliban gained control of the country in mid-August is breathtaking. Most affected are the country's 38 million people, many of whom are unable to support themselves. The latest assessment by the UN Development Programme forecasts 97% of households in Afghanistan could sink below the poverty line by early to mid-2022 if the country's political and economic crisis is not urgently addressed. UNDP Administrator Achim Steiner acknowledges the country is in desperate need of humanitarian assistance. At the same time, however, he says measures must be taken to keep the local economies going. He says international aid alone cannot keep 38 million Afghans alive.
We have to step in. We have to stabilize a people's economy. And in addition to saving lives in the immediate, we also have to save livelihoods, because otherwise we will confront indeed a scenario through this winter and into next year where millions and millions of Afghans are simply unable to stay on the land, in their homes, in their villages, and survive.
The UNDP has established a special trust fund for Afghanistan to protect the hard-won development gains the country has achieved over the past 20 years. Countries can channel funding for specific development and livelihood projects through this program. Kani Wignaraja is Assistant Secretary General and Director of the Regional Bureau for Asia Pacific. She says the money will go directly to community groups and community members.
It will provide a cash for work to support small public works efforts. As Achim said, it will provide a temporary basic income for the most vulnerable, including elderly and disabled. It will work with a number of UN agencies, with international and national NGO partners who are on the ground.
UNDP estimates $667 million will be needed to cover the cost of livelihood activities for 4.5 million Afghans in the first year. It hopes to double the number of beneficiaries in the second year if it is able to double the size of funding. The agency says the launch of the trust fund is off to a good start, with a contribution of 50 million euros from the German government. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A COVID-19 lockdown in the Australian city of Melbourne, officially the world's most locked down city, ended Thursday. Restrictions on leaving home will be lifted and a nighttime curfew will be scrapped because the state of Victoria has met its double dose vaccination target of 70%. From Sydney, Phil Masser reports.
It's a record that no one wants. Since the pandemic began, Melbourne, a city of 5 million people, has had six lockdowns. In total, it spent more than 260 days under some of Australia's toughest COVID-19 restrictions. It recently passed Buenos Aires in Argentina as the world's most locked down city. Pubs, cafes and hairdressers will reopen in Melbourne when the lockdown ends just before midnight Thursday. The new freedoms, however, apply only to the fully vaccinated. As the lockdown ends, the state of Victoria has recorded one of its highest daily totals of new coronavirus cases, with 2,232 infections and 12 fatalities reported Thursday. Nancy Baxter, an epidemiologist at the University of Melbourne, says the community still needs to be cautious.
We all need to use our heads when we're getting out of lockdown. People deserve some freedoms. They should enjoy some new freedoms. But they do need to think about how much COVID is out there. In Melbourne right now, we have as much COVID as they have in all of Spain. So, you know, if people kind of don't feel comfortable doing all the things that, you know, their friends are inviting them to do, I think it's important for people not to feel like they're boring or they're afraid.
Masks are still mandatory both indoors and outdoors for all people in Victoria State. Residents of Melbourne must continue to work from home if they can, and travel between the city and regional areas is only allowed with a permit. More restrictions will end, including the reopening of most shops, when the state of Victoria's vaccination rate hits 80%. Lockdowns in Sydney and Canberra have also recently been lifted. Australia has recorded 150,000 coronavirus cases and more than 1,500 deaths since the pandemic began. More than 70% of the population has been fully vaccinated. International travel, heavily restricted in Australia since its borders were closed to most foreign nationals in March 2020, could resume as soon as November. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney, Australia.
And in other news, President Vladimir Putin said on Thursday that the Western-backed military development of Ukraine posed a serious threat to Russia, 2 days after the U.S. Defense Secretary staged a show of support for Kyiv and encouraged its aspiration to join NATO. The United States has been Ukraine's most powerful backer since Russia's 2014 annexation of Crimea and the outbreak of a war the same year between Russian separatists and government forces in eastern Ukraine. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. And while on there, check out our other programs, Upfront Show, Africa 54, Straight Talk, and many others. And remember to connect with us on our social media platforms. We are at VOA Africa on all platforms. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Two Caltech astronomers started repos in the rings of Saturn and were able to learn more about the composition of the gas giant's planet core. Rick Pantleo tells us more in today's Science in a Minute.
This is Science in a Minute.
Two Caltech astronomers took data from NASA's Cassini mission to study ripples within Saturn's famous rings. The astronomers traced the source of the ripples back to oscillations in the interior of Saturn, which they say caused the gas giant to jiggle a bit. After analyzing the ripples, the astronomers Christopher Mankiewicz and Jim Fuller say that they got a new understanding of the composition of Saturn's core. Rather than it being made of solid and hard rock as previously theorized, the Caltech researchers say their findings suggest that the core is a kind of slushy mix of ice, rock, and metallic fluids, something they refer to as a fuzzy core. The astronomers' analysis also shows that Saturn's core stretches across about 60% of its diameter, which is much larger than previously thought. A study detailing the findings has been accepted by the journal Nature Astronomy. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
In Nigeria, with more than 60% of the population living below the poverty line, educators are figuring out new ways to prepare young people for the future job market in the country. This was one of the major issues discussed when the University of Lagos hosted global experts to discuss the future of universities. From Lagos, Samuel Okocha reports on what the University of Lagos is doing to equip students for gainful employment and how it fits into the conversation around the future of African universities.
African universities must undertake strategic collaborations, boost innovation, and develop entrepreneurial initiatives that target the needs of students to remain relevant in the future. These concerns formed the core of discussions when global experts gathered over Zoom and in person to discuss the future of African universities at the second edition of the University of Lagos UNILAG International Week Conference. But a major talking point at the conference was the employability of graduates leaving African universities, along with how universities can promote entrepreneurship. To address these concerns, students joining the University of Lagos this year and henceforth will have to take a mandatory module on entrepreneurship before they graduate.
What we're trying to do is build the capacity of our students to think innovatively around what it is that they're currently doing.
Professor Ayodele Atenuwa serves as the Deputy Vice Chancellor for Development Services at the University of Lagos.
We do not want people to graduate and say, I don't know what I'm going to do with that course. We are saying we're opening eyes to see what you can do with that course and what you can do outside that course. And we're saying that howsoever you're thinking innovatively, we're here to support you.
The Vice Chancellor, University of Lagos, Professor Oluwatunyi Ogundibe, said the needs of students will need to form the major focus for Africa's higher education sector in the digital age.
Gone are those days that you just the lecture notes you prepare 10, 20 years ago will still be relevant now. No, you need to try and upgrade yourself. You need to try and get exposed. You need to try and be relevant so that when you are teaching your students, you know, if you are teaching your student now, they'll start Googling, they will be searching. So whatever you are saying, if you are going to copy one book, they will just be laughing when you are teaching them. So the university of the future is about the student.
The UNILAG Vice Chancellor said collaborations between neighboring universities were also important in solving local problems like unemployment.
What we are doing now is that we are entering into collaboration with young universities. We have collaboration with Borno State University. We have collaboration with Akwa Ibom State University. We have collaboration with Akwa Ibom State Government in the area of entrepreneurship and innovation. So we need to look inward and see what we can do to develop the potentials in Nigeria.
That is particularly important, a country with a huge youth demographic, with half the population being aged 19 or under. Samuel Okocha in Lagos for VOA News.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very great weekend.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
The World Health Organization and Africa Center for Disease Control say we all can help fight the global pandemic by frequently washing our hands with soap and water or using hand sanitizers. For more information on protecting yourself and others, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa Center for Disease Control. And remember to listen to VOA.